Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions and the law. My name is Matthew Kurbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Natalie Knowlton. Natalie is the founder of Access to Justice Ventures, which helps empower entrepreneurs building scalable access to justice solutions. This is the second time Natalie was on the podcast, who's always a welcomed guest because of her knowledge of the legal tech and justice tech spaces and her insight into what is coming and what needs to be done to improve the legal profession and legal services. Thank you to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel. Links to both in the show notes, more on them later. And remember to use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. You get 10% off and it supports the show. The best way to support the show is to share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. I'm thrilled to have with me, for the second time I'm doing this on the show, a second appearance from a prior guest. Our returning guest, Natalie Knowlton, was previously on episode 6. So at the time of publication of that episode, Natalie had announced that she had launched Access to Justice Ventures. So I did put that into the description, but we didn't talk about it because Natalie and I had recorded that conversation like close to a year before I actually published it. And well, first of all, Natalie, say hello.
Hi, everyone. It's really great to be back here. I was excited to be in on the first round. And Matthew, thank you for having me for a second time.
Of course. Of course. And I want to thank you because like when I was doing those initial interviews, I was a nobody. Like I was just some random lawyer. I mean, I had been chair of the law student division of the ABA, but that's like, unless you're involved in the ABA, you didn't know who I was. And so we gelled well and you believed in me and you trusted me and you let me record you on a podcast, which like podcasts have been around, but like random people having podcasts really surged in the pandemic. So like, thank you for coming on the show originally when you did.
No, of course. Yeah. Everyone has something to contribute to this space. And I think you have a unique voice.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And I'm so glad to have you back on because you're a thought leader in the space as well. And I want my listeners, if they listened to that last episode, especially to know what you've been working on since then. But just in case they haven't gone back and listened, because my audience has seriously grown since the last time your episode went live, just do like a quick introduction for yourself.
Sure. So let's see. I'll start with where I kind of cut my teeth in this access to justice space. So for many, 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 many years, I worked at IELTS, which is the Institute for the Advancement of the American Legal System at the University of Denver. And IELTS is dedicated to civil justice reform. I worked a lot in the family justice reform space there. And then over the last maybe 3 or 4 years in the regulatory innovation space. And I developed a real passion working in those areas for the voice of the self-represented litigant, for the plight of people going through the legal system without an attorney, and for just the general impact that the lack of access to legal services has had on our society. So being at IELTS is a research institute, empirical research institute, and I did a lot of qualitative research while I was there. I worked with a lot of great organizations and I did some advocacy, but I became really interested in taking my passion to a new advocacy level, which doesn't really gel well in the empirical research kind of nonprofit space. You really want to have an objectivity that I realized I wanted to kind of move away from. I wanted to take a strong stance on an issue. And that did not align with IELTS' mission, and nor should it. So I decided I wanted to go out on my own and open a consultancy that would allow me to really take a frontline stance on some of the issues that I'm really passionate about, to advocate in front of different groups and organizations, government, non-government, for the changes that I wanted to see happen in the legal system, and also to work directly with some of the people on the ground who were doing the things that I thought should be happening and who were interested in pushing the bounds of some of the innovation in the space. So I left IELTS and started my own consultancy, Access to Justice Ventures, and that's where I am now.
So the website is a2jventures.com, link, of course, in the show notes. So I highly recommend that the listeners go and check that out. But just for somebody like the elevator pitch for that, like if you're in a room of people and they're like, well, what is A2J Ventures? Like how do you explain it?
So the mission at A2J Ventures is to assist entrepreneurs, and by entrepreneurs, it could be lawyers or non-lawyers, technologists and others who are interested in developing scalable justice solutions. So there's a really important focus for me on scalability. The one-to-one model is broken. in the sense that it's just not serving the need. It's a great, great model, obviously, traditionally for those who can afford legal services. But in terms of those who can't, and I'm preaching to the choir here with you and subscription models, but I truly believe that the one-to-many model is the future of access to justice and legal services. So I wanted to empower entrepreneurs who are developing those. And of course, technology is a core component of those kinds of scalable services. So our clients, I often focus in areas of regulatory uncertainty or regulatory innovation. A lot of my clients are interested in the Utah regulatory sandbox, where you have relaxed rules on unauthorized practice of law and Rule 5.4 fee sharing and co-ownership, or the Arizona alternative business structure, which allows for non-lawyers and lawyers to come together and co-own law firms and fee share. So those are the bulk of my clients now. But I'm hoping, as kind of tying it back to the advocacy work, I'm hoping as more and more states begin adopting these new regulatory innovations that I'll be able to increase the number of companies and entrepreneurs that I can help.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I'm so glad that you phrased it that way, because, of course, in my opinion, like, the subscription model is the best business model to scale one to many. And, you know, there are different ways it could be adapted to different practice areas. And, you know, certainly when you're looking in, even outside of like the traditional law firm structure, are you seeing those entities using some version of the subscription model or alternative fees that are definitely not the billable hour, which doesn't scale?
Yeah, most of the justice technology companies that I'm seeing that are making waves these days are using alternative fee structures, particularly now that we're grappling with generative AI and how that is going to make things so much more efficient if you're using it correctly, of course. I think we're having a real conversation about the billable hour and whether it's sustainable. So I think alternative fee structures are the future. And I think those who are continuing to use a billable hour are really going to have to reconcile how they're charging when they're not spending as many hours doing the same amount of work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've said in the past, and I think I did a LinkedIn Live with Carolyn Elephant when we were talking about this, and I think I did the math wrong, because I was like, well, if somebody's thing used to, you know, research project used to take them 10 hours and now it takes them 10 minutes. Which, first of all, it used to take 10 hours and now it takes 1 minute. But let's just say, like, it took 10 hours and now it takes 10 minutes. I was like, what are they going to 10x their rate? But that's not how you do math. It's actually 60 times your rate, right? Like, you have to multiply it by 60 to get to the same income that you would have earned. Nobody's going to want to pay whatever your rate is right now as a billable hour attorney multiplied by 60 for you to get the same juice out of that squeeze from that client. It's not realistic. And that has probably been, other than coming out of the pandemic, like, the Gen AI thing has been sort of the biggest development, period, but especially in legal since you and I last spoke. So yeah, tell me more about like what you're seeing. Are you seeing these alternative providers using it? You know, what should lawyers be thinking about if we're using it too?
There are some really important ethical issues that I think attorneys need to think about, not just think, but we will need to think about the rules of professional conduct and what a reasonable fee is. A reasonable fee, as you're pointing out, becomes unreasonable when you've done 1 minute of work and are billing for 10 hours of work. So we're going to have to answer those questions. I also, in terms of just the efficiencies that attorneys can build in, it does lend itself to a flat rate. It does lend itself to a subscription service. You might, as an attorney, be able to save money in terms of your time that it takes you to do things, but it's a potential moneymaker also for firms. If you balance that out and you have a reasonable fee, you increase efficiencies. And the heart of the one-to-many model in terms of like productization or commoditization of legal services is that you're creating one thing once and then selling it to consumers at scale. And I think generative AI is going to make it a lot more efficient and doable for attorneys to create that kind of legal service or product.
Yeah, and of course, also since I last had you, the show became more legitimate and I got some sponsors, one of them being Gavel, which helps lawyers productize legal services, right? And they even just announced, that they've built like a generative AI part of their platform to help lawyers productize their legal services and make their, you know, the automations on Gavel, which is like really like, I know they're like a sponsor or whatever, but they're a sponsor for a reason. Like, there's incredible synergy with what I'm trying to accomplish and what they're trying to accomplish. But that would be like one of the tools that could help accomplish what you're talking about, right?
Absolutely. And I have very high regard for the Gavel team. They're doing fantastic work.
Now, for maybe the uninitiated in the generative AI space, when you said there are serious ethical concerns, I think maybe some of the listeners' minds went to, well, putting in confidential client information as well into these systems, not the ethics necessarily of like using inefficient billing practices, which is, of course, also in many jurisdictions' ethical standards. You can't use inefficient billing practices. But has there been like what have you been learning as you're learning more about how the legal profession can use this technology about also maintaining those types of ethical requirements?
Well, fortunately, there are a lot of states that are considering generative AI and how that will impact the rules of ethics that govern attorneys in our practice. So I think we'll have some guidance coming out from a few states not too long, but there are things to consider. For example, billing, we talked about that. There's a question as to whether, you know, a question just in general discourse as to whether you should be disclosing the use of generative AI tools and whether you should be disclosing to consumers and clients. And I don't necessarily want to take a position on that, but I think on one hand, what lawyer is not using AI in the course of his or her practice right now? It could be, well, you name the program, but AI is integrated into so many of our tools that we use on a day-to-day basis. On the other hand, as we talk about the value that lawyers can add to consumers, and if you bake that value into a different billing structure, if you're using generative AI and doing fewer hours of work, it could be a benefit. It could be a leg up to others if you disclose that to consumers. So I think attorneys will really just need to first understand how to use these tools and how they might use these tools in their practice, and then walk through some of the issues in terms of implications on billing. Implications on developing new tech competence. Of course, tech competence is something that's baked into most states' rules of ethics at this point. We've heard a few large horror stories that have been widespread and broadcasted about the use of generative AI inappropriately. So that will be something that attorneys will have to wrestle with. And then figuring out how to build the use of these tools into advertising and marketing practices so that it can be something that's a value add to consumers.
Yeah. I mean, you know, gosh, there's so much to cover there. But one of the things that I think is going back to this disclosure piece, I am definitely disclosing to potential clients that, and current clients, like I'm using AI, not just generative AI, but like other machine learning for analysis and for comparison. And so not necessarily generation, though of course I am for that too, because when I'm not billing my time, like I also want it to be crystal clear that like, how I'm able to do that is through automation and using technology that I could offer really accessible prices. Because I've learned over the last 18, 19 months that some people are like, well, how can you possibly be making money charging such low prices? And are you just like a really bad lawyer? And I've only really gotten the really bad lawyer thing like a couple of times. It's like, no, like the reason I'm offering low prices is because I'm just super efficient. And so it doesn't take me long to handle things. And AI makes me extra super efficient in doing it. So I am definitely disclosing it. I don't think, and I'm curious to get your perspective on this part too, I don't think we're going to always be in a position where it makes sense to disclose or using generative AI. Just like I don't tell my clients, I use the internet, right? Like you said,
right.
It's kind of been just built into things. Like clients don't need to hear, like, I'm a lawyer, I use the internet. Could you imagine if a potential client would think like, well, if that attorney has to tell me they're using the internet, I don't think I'm going to hire them. What are your
right,
thoughts?
Or I use email. Could you imagine?
Right.
I don't know that I'll take a strong position on it. I think it really is an attorney assessment as to whether they think the client would be receptive to knowing that they're using technology to increase efficiency in their practice. But any attorney who's using technology, whether it's generative AI or not, that is definitely a selling point for consumers, I think. And there have been two recent studies that came out. I believe one is a LexisNexis study of generative AI that talked to several thousand attorneys and some consumers. And then the Clio Legal Trends Report came out at Clio earlier this week. And both of those reports show that consumers are more bullish on generative AI than our lawyers. So I think there are some concerns that lawyers have that consumers will be scared off by this use of technology. I don't know that these are necessarily founded based on the data that we have on that. So I think understanding the kind of consumer base that you have and their appetite for understanding your technology. But again, there's just so much that we're already doing to create efficiencies that I'm not sure it makes sense to even distinguish generative AI from some of the other tools that we use to make our life easier and our services cheaper.
Yeah.
Cheaper or better, I should say. Sorry.
Yes. Yeah, because both can be true. Both could absolutely be true. Going back to your one-to-many model, because if you could do cheaper and better and more efficient, you could, you know, sell. It's just easier to do that for more people, and then you could actually make more money than if you were doing the one-to-one billing time thing. How do you feel about something like this? Because I know the last time you were on, something that you talked about was lawyers having to be okay with selling legal information, or like non-lawyers selling legal information because it's not legal advice. So how do you feel about because I'm trying to figure out a way to do this, is a subscriber benefit. So to like a subscription-based law firm, a generative AI like chatbot that says like, hey, this is a generative AI chatbot, because right now there's a lot of chatbots that are like pretending to be an employee at the firm, right? And as a subscriber benefit, like you get access to this Gen AI chatbot that's been trained on all this firm's data. And so you can now ask it questions that you might ask your lawyer and get answers to your questions without even having to talk to the lawyer. But if you can't, now the lawyer can come in and like read the transcript of like this back and forth with the AI chatbot and then be able to quickly get to like the problem and solve the problem for wherever the AI chatbot couldn't go. Because I still feel like you'd have to stop the bot or program it to be like, you know, that would be a question for your lawyer because that's asking for legal advice kind of a thing. How do you feel about that type of thing? And are you seeing anything like this out there? I'm also asking because I would love to find the tool that I could integrate in my client portal that would let me do that.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. And I think chatbots are already in use at firms and by legal services providers. And so powering up a Gen AI chatbot that is a bit more reactive in ways that resonate with the consumer or a bit more reflective of consumer questions and consumer needs makes a lot of sense. So the issue, of course, with any chatbot is whether it provides value to the consumer. And I really like your continuous improvement built into the model that you just described, where the attorney is paying attention to what is not being answered and paying attention to what is being answered and ensuring that that information is the most helpful to the consumer. But I think that holds a lot of promise. I know that Tom Martin over at LawDroid does a lot of work on these things and helps a lot of firms and others. He built out, I believe, a chatbot with Patrick Pallas and Pallas Law. I think that's called PatBot. So I know that they've been working on something in that space. And then Tom has also worked with, for example, Judge Scott Schlegel, who used to be a district court judge in Louisiana. He's now on the appellate bench. And Judge Schlegel was looking at how to develop a chatbot in the Louisiana courts for civil and criminal litigants without lawyers to ask simple questions. Obviously, it's not a chatbot, just ChatGPT. It's been trained on sources of truth, but they're envisioning that in the actual court context, which is a lot more restrictive than what a law firm could offer because they have very stringent rules of maintaining neutrality and you have to ensure the accuracy of information. But I think the door's open and the cat's out of the bag on those types of tools. And I personally hope that we see a lot more.
Have you come across a tool called Paxton.ai yet?
I have not, but now that you've mentioned it, I will check it out.
So it is still, at the time of recording anyway, in free beta. And so you get full use of it, you know, for whatever you want to do for free beta. So I've been using it now for like 4 or 5 months. And I've used a lot of the generative AI tools out there. And this is by far, this is more than just generative AI. It has immediately become my absolute favorite tool. And you know, these episodes might not be they might be published in a different order, but I just interviewed their founder and CEO for my podcast yesterday. And something that came up in that conversation was how like anyone could use it. Like it's called Paxton AI, like your legal AI assistant for lawyers. But there's nothing stopping just like people in traffic court from querying Paxton about the laws. Because the thing about Paxton is it's trained on all U.S. federal and state laws. Every single one. So like it is, and it's made to not hallucinate because it's either you have to select the source of data, whether it's like whatever jurisdiction or upload documents before it will provide you an answer. And so they get practically no hallucinations. I think maybe he even said like, we don't get any hallucinations because of the way they've set up their model. And so I asked him about like, would you be interested in like just giving this to like courthouses, like to let people access? And because I also knew I was interviewing you, you know, today, like the next day, like that I could get your perspective on this from the access to justice perspective. Like, a technology like that would be incredibly powerful. And like right now it's free. Like everyone should be signing up and using it, whether you're a lawyer or not. What do you think about that?
So I love the public-private partnership in the access to justice space. It is absolutely critical. And I think there, as we look at these generative AI tools and the companies behind them, it's really easy to see this increasing divide between those who have access to the latest and greatest large language models and those who do not. Those who have access to tools that can be tailored to the specific needs of providers or their constituents and those that cannot. So I love the, as you describe it, this kind of tool that could be given free of charge to courts and legal aid providers, for example, those who are serving people in the subsidized legal services space. I implore companies like Paxton and others to consider those kinds of partnerships and to the extent that they can allow for access for providers who might not be able to afford the high rates that corporate America and large law firms can, but who are really serving the critical core of the access to justice need in the U.S. And so I think that's a fantastic, sounds like a great tool. I'll check it out. But the partnerships between a company like that and providers in the space, I think, hold a lot of promise for ensuring fairly somewhat equal distribution of these tools across the space.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really an incredible tool. Like you could upload like a lease, for example, if you're a tenant. And be like, and like, ask it questions about your lease, right? And it will cite to everything, like every response, like has like a citation either to the lease or a specific like statute, and then it requires like you follow up and actually make sure like that is the right applicable statute and all that. So there's still room for lawyers there if somebody wants to take it to that next level. But when we're talking about access, even at $20 a month and $50 a page, which is what my starting pricing is. There are people in America who can't afford that. And so to have a tool like this that's there, like even if the government had to pay something to Paxton so that it would like break even for the cost of implementing it, right? First of all, it would be incredible growth tool, I think, for the company to get brand recognition and for clients to be asking their lawyers, well, I started with this Paxton at the court thing, right? So like you'd think that that would be a good reason to do it. But if that tool doesn't do it, and depending on, because now they have investors, and so I'm not sure, like, you know, they have to do stuff because they have investors now. But there's got to be some tool out there that should be used for that, because it's sort of a no-brainer, I feel like. And as taxpayers, don't we want the court process to go like a heck of a lot smoother because we'd be saving tax dollars, right? Like, has that been part of the process of trying to educate lawyers and people on why this types of technology like needs to be at the courthouses? When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form and scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
Yeah, well, and then the courthouse is an interesting example because the courthouse has more restrictions on the kinds of technology vendors that they can partner with for any number of reasons that I, you know, can't really get into. We don't have time to get into here. But I think it's important that we start looking at these trusted vendors and developing out a list of these trusted vendors. Courts can develop standards for technologies and vendors like this. There are some, and I think an increasing number of examples of courts partnering with vendors like this. So I think that's absolutely critical. I'll put in a plug here as well. I'm working with a company, Screens AI. They're developing tools and they're working specifically with community organizations and nonprofit legal services providers to provide the service for free that allows for initially a generative AI review of the contract in order to understand if it the contract meets certain key standards that you would want in a contract, but also to provide a more open-ended assessment of what the terms of the contract are. They're working with legal services providers for that kind of down the road, late intervention stage, but also trying to get further up the road to upstream interventions to allow consumers to understand better what they're signing and what these agreements are and try to remedy that asymmetry of information. So I just use that as an example of the power of generative AI when leveraged through trusted sources like attorneys and legal services providers and courts to provide consumers with increased information and understanding about their rights and obligations.
Is there any unique spelling to Screens AI? Because I want to check them out.
Screens.ai.
I'm signing up
for is it live
right now?
Okay, perfect. Well, then, yeah, that's good.
Well, speaking of Tom Martin earlier, you're just coming off of CleoCon or CleoCloud Conference, is the technical name. And right before that was the American Legal Technology Innovation Awards, right? So let's, and Tom's one of the co-founders of that. So tell us what's your reporting on. What was your experience at the awards?
Yeah, so it's the American Legal Technology Awards, Tom Martin, Patrick Pallas, Kat Moon, co-founders. It's such a fun event. They launched this, I think, right around the pandemic. So we were not able to get together in person until last year. Last year was the first time, and they tied it together with the Clio conference, which has been in Nashville this year and last. I just love it. It's fantastic. I call it Law Prom. A lot of people call it Law Prom now. It's just an opportunity for a lot of people in this space. Legal tech is kind of a tight-knit space or a lot of friends. And so let's move beyond that traditional rubber chicken dinner where everybody is very formal, and let's all get together, acknowledge new players in the space. So Patrick Pallas and some of his remarks, and Tom iterated this as well, they acknowledge that there's a lot that we don't know. There are a lot of people out there doing really cool things, and it's impossible to know about everybody. And so the American Legal Technology Awards allows the founders and then those who they invite and share this event with, which is open to the public, to come and learn about the fantastic work that's happening. What I particularly love about the awards is that they have different categories of legal technology innovators and organizations. And I think that's somewhat rare, because you'll find a certain group will bestow an award on, for example, an access to justice innovator. Other groups honor in-house or corporate innovators. But American Legal Technology Awards, they really recognize that innovation happens across the space, and let's just bring it all together, because there are important things that you can learn in the access to justice space, for example, from corporate innovation and vice versa. So I see a lot of new faces, learn a lot of new companies when I'm there. I also see a lot of friends who are doing fantastic work, and I just love seeing them being acknowledged for the work that they're doing. It's a great time. I encourage anyone who is interested to follow the American Legal Technology Awards, tune in, certainly participate in nominating individuals. It's a very simple form, has been the last few years. Nominate your friends, your family, your favorite companies. Those nominations go out over social media, and let's just increase the volume of incredible entrepreneurs and innovators who are being thrown into that mix.
Yeah, and I'm happy to say I was nominated for the individual category. Sandra Sandoval with Justicia Lab ran away with the award, but I was disappointed that I wasn't able to make it this year, family obligations and all that. But I will tell you that it was an absolute honor to be recognized, because I'm literally just an individual with a podcast and a practice that's a little bit different, right? But Natalie, you are also, like, you're involved, right, with that, because you're a judge. So, like, you get to look at, like, all of these. So we only, you know, the general public, we might only see the nominees, but, like, you got to see, like, all the people that didn't even get ultimately not, or that didn't get selected as a finalist, right? So, like, and especially, like, because of your position of what you do, it's actually probably really useful and relevant, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a really, really brutal, difficult task to choose. And I'm in the Access to Justice Award category, and over the last couple of years, we've just seen it explode. So this year, the American Legal Technology team broke out the award, the Access to Justice Award, into an individual, a nonprofit entity, and a legal technology company. I believe those were the three. So that just shows you how many. We had so many nominations in that category that we had to break it out and honor. We got to break it out and honor more individuals. But yeah, it's fantastic. And it really does introduce me to new companies and players in this space who I wouldn't have seen otherwise.
Right. And especially doing what you're doing. I mean, their potential partners, like, you know, in the future with what you're trying to accomplish. So hopefully that means their likelihood of success is going to be greater now that you know of them and they know of you, right?
Well, we can only hope so.
I mean, it's you know, it's, I think it's very promising that there is so much interest in solving that problem because, like, there is money to be made. Like, it's not, you can't make stupid, expensive law firm billable hour money, but, like, there's money to be made to help people solve their problems, which makes me want to challenge even the concept of access to justice, if I may, with you.
Sure.
Sorry, this wasn't in the prep conversation that we had, but it just came to me. I've talked about this a little bit, and that is the concept of access to justice somewhat flawed from at least an attorney's perspective? Because lawyers, the whole concept is that we wait until people need justice, and now the lawyers or even the alternative legal service providers come in to solve their problems after they need justice. Shouldn't we have an avoid the need for access to justice solution that people are trying to accomplish? And like, and then with that, how do we even do that?
Yeah, so I think there's any number of ways to define access to justice. And I won't get into that here because there are just 100 different ways to do that. But I define it very broadly. And I think access to justice absolutely incorporates upstream interventions. Preventative legal services is something that has been out in our world, at least for a very long time. You see legal insurance companies who are trying to get consumers to think about insurance in terms of legal issues that might arise. I think it holds great promise there. I do think there's a marketing component to this, and this came up a bit in some conversations I was having at Clio. Preventative legal services doesn't quite have the same, I think, impact on the consumer that preventative health services does. You know that you need to be healthy. Your body is something you live with every day. The aches and pains, you know, you feel them all the time. And you see people around you who their health might be struggling. So it's easy for you to make that distinction between I'm going to get sick and go to the doctor, or I'm going to try not to get sick. Legal services in the people law sector is a bit different because most of the time you have people who engage with the system once, maybe twice. If you ask a consumer on the street, do you anticipate having a legal issue in the next year? A, they're probably not going to understand what a legal issue is because we have that whole latent legal market and the lack of understanding what constitutes a legal issue. And B, they're probably going to say no because, well, I'm not married, so I'm not going to get a divorce. I'm not going to break the law. I'm pretty certain of that. So I don't have to worry about that. But legal issues can arise from a number of different places, and they often arise unexpectedly because if you're expecting it, then probably you're going to try to prevent it in the first instance. So I think there are creative ways that lawyers can work with other providers to build more awareness and more consumer services into preventing legal issues. And that's where I do think some of the regulatory reform that I've talked about holds promise, because it encourages this more interdisciplinary look at delivering legal services in a way that acknowledges legal as part of a broader human problem. So how can we address that? And then how can we help prevent that going, you know, further upstream? So yeah, I don't know if it would call into question access to justice for me necessarily, but I think it's a core component of access to justice.
I really like the way that you've defined it as an upstream access to justice problem. I think that's a great way to think about it because, you know, like I've said this before on the podcast, but it's worth mentioning again because it just shows you like how you can do it is I subscribe to my electrical and plumbing company. Mm-hmm. I only pay $9 a month, but I know I'm going to have electrical and plumbing issues. It's going to happen and maybe more common than like a legal problem per se, right? But, you know, are you a renter? Do you have a mortgage? Do you lease or, you know, your car? Do you have a loan on your car? You know, do you buy insurance? Buying insurance is agreeing to a contract, right? Like little things we do every day. You work at a company, you're an employee, you own a company, you're an employer individually or as a business owner, as an employee, like there are legal considerations. It's the operating system of society. Every day, every moment, there's a legal thing that happens. So, you know, it's just like, how do we, like, but we have an education gap. Like you said, like the latent legal market, yeah. Like lawyers issue spot via advertising to potential clients. Like there has to be a better way. And this is what I love about the generative AI space is like that tool like Paxton, when you ask it a question, it recommends 5 follow-up questions. I can recommend up to 5 follow-up questions. And it's basically issue spotting. So it's like, it helps me do my job as a lawyer because it issue spots for things I was going to issue spot anyway. But for the layperson, like, there's your issue spotting, right? And if they know more about legal problems, well, maybe they're actually going to hire lawyers on the front end, which is where the subscription model comes in. Just like I'm subscribing to my plumbing company, right? And I subscribe to them because I get a free annual inspection and I get 10% discount on plumbing and electrical services. So it's kind of a no-brainer. Are you seeing any law firms or alternative legal service providers or ABSs in Arizona like trying to do something like that, like prospective, like legal problem avoidance?
I'm not sure I can speak to that. I don't know if it's a case that I'm not seeing it or I'm just not kind of looking at it through that lens. I think there is the need for lawyers to prove this concept in a way and show that it can have legs from a financial standpoint. So I think right now traditional providers are more focused on where they have been, which is downstream. And once a conflict arises, I think there's a lot of implications on courts as well. So when we talk about increasing access to justice, we think about let's allow more people to have access to law in the courts. But what happens when they do have access to the law in the courts? The court system is not set up to accommodate a ton more of people coming into it. It can't, in many places, it cannot accommodate the caseload that it has. We're looking at massive backlogs, particularly after COVID. So I think courts are starting to look upstream too. And I think there's a potential to integrate some preventative legal services, whether that looks like legal information about things that might not be within the purview of the courts yet, because it's not a dispute, case and controversy. So I think there's a lot of potential there. I don't know that I'm seeing it right now in the market, but hopefully soon.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not seeing it. But, you know, just in light of what you do, I was wondering if that was something that you've seen. I've talked before on like, how do you even market like problem avoidance? You know, like people don't buy unless they really have intention or a problem, right? So like it's, you know, although we do buy insurance, but a lot of times like it's required. Like in Illinois, you must have car insurance of a minimum coverage amount, right? Like, so we force people's hands. Should we force people's hands for having, you know, prospective legal services? I don't know. You know, it's an interesting idea. Though we are running out of time and I feel like we talk about stuff all day. You spoke at Tech Show. And this is somewhat what you covered at Tech Show last year. And I was also a speaker at Tech Show last year. And you and I are both going to be faculty again this year at ABA Tech Show. So maybe for those who couldn't make it to last year's talks that you gave, maybe just give like a quick summary and then give us a glimpse of what you'll be talking about in 2024.
Yeah. So I love ABA Tech Show. It's one of my favorite conferences. I'm probably heavily biased because I have so many friends and colleagues there. It's just a fantastic gathering. So last year at Tech Show, I spoke predominantly about legal regulatory innovation. And because it's an audience of lawyers, I spoke about how lawyers can be involved in this. I think when we hear regulatory innovation, particularly when it's allowing new players into the space, allowing new funding sources in the space, there's a big concern that lawyers are going to be put out of work, that competition is going to come in and harm the legal service providers that exist in the space now. So I wanted to make it clear that in the regulatory space that we're seeing in Utah and Arizona, a lot of these are lawyers and law firms that are benefiting from these regulatory reforms. So I wanted to highlight that. And then I wanted to talk about some of the business models and partnerships that lawyers can enter into in these new regulatory spaces. So that was great to talk last year about that. I will be returning, as you mentioned, this coming February 2024, talking about legal regulations and technology and investment in that space, and then separately talking about generative AI and how using that can amplify access to justice and legal services delivery. So we're still in the stage at this recording time of hammering down the discrete agenda items within those two sessions, but I'm really looking forward to it. Again, just a big plug, ABA Tech Show is a fantastic gathering, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you as well there.
Yeah. And I am talking about whether making sure lawyers are prepared for the end of the billable hour with generative AI, of course. So my talk is very much focused on how to use the subscription model and generative AI in tandem. But then also, and I'll be speaking with Stephanie Everett, who's also been a guest on the show, and she's with Lawyerist. But and then I'll be talking about podcasting for lawyers. And maybe surprisingly, there's actually a lot of artificial intelligence involved in how to produce and make a podcast these days. So you can't escape generative AI at Tech Show 2024. It's going to be everywhere. Before I let you go, if I have to ask, if the American Legal Technology Awards is Law Prom, what is ABA Tech Show?
That's a great question. I would call it Law Twitter Spring Break.
Law, yeah. Spring Break? Is it Law X Spring Break now?
Still law Twitter to me. I'm not there yet. I think it might always be law Twitter or Twitter to me. Yeah, I think it's on the spring break side of things. Although it is in a non-spring break type place, Chicago in February is not known for its spring break ambiance, but it has the energy and excitement of being with friends and family on a vacation on an island somewhere where you just get to experience and be with some of the greatest influencers, I think, in the space. And it's just a ton of fun.
Yeah, it's a great time. And with that, I've already asked you the question of, is a hot dog a sandwich? And so I'm starting a new tradition with second time guests. And that is a calzone a sandwich and why?
It is absolutely not a sandwich. And I would say, having no authority in this space at all, it's because when I look at sandwiches, they have layers that are visual to the eye. You can see the layers. A calzone is kind of just a lump folded together, more like a piece of bread with stuff inside it. That's kind of how I would say. So yeah, firmly on the side of calzone is not a sandwich.
So if you go back and listen to Lauren Lester's answer to that question, because he's the only one to answer it. So everybody, that is episode 27. Lauren has a very different answer to that question. And so it's going to be easier to compare those because everyone has a different answer to, is a hot dog a sandwich? Natalie, thank you so much for coming on the show for a second time. If people wanted to follow up with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
At this time of recording, I'm still a fan of being on Twitter and engaging with people there. So you can follow me at Natal Alleycat. That's NatalAlleyCat. You can also, through that handle, follow me on or connect with me on Blue Sky, Threads, LinkedIn. It's all Natal Alleycat.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
And that's our show. Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for being sponsors. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with somebody you think would find value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.